him. In the end, Edwin probably got asylum. As his lawyer explained, Edwin had actually bolstered his case for asylum by lying, because while he might not have been wanted by Nigerian officials before, since defaming them in his application, he's in danger. He's been targeted. Most likely, Edwin is currently engaging in credit card schemes from a housing project in Staten Island. Oscar for playing a gang rape victim. In 2001, The New Yorker described the dramatic performance of one immigrant during her asylum interview. The applicant, Caroline, wept, closed her eyes, and whispered as she told her story of being repeatedly arrested, beaten, sodomized, and raped by soldiers in her country. They, quote, took me by the head, and they put my head against their penis, she said. They spat on us. They wanted us to do things. They beat us up and did horrible things to us. They forced us to do fellatio, and they put objects in our genitals. They stamped on us. They trampled us for 3 days. I suffered many infections because of the rape. My kidneys got infected. Although Caroline claimed she had been repeatedly hospitalized on account of these barbarities, she could produce no evidence, quote, because of all the riots and the pillages. She had no proof of her abortion because, quote, I don't want any documentary evidence of this abortion because it happened as a result of rape. If she were sent back, she said, I might be killed on the road because I am a member of the opposition. The immigration officer interviewing Caroline was notoriously tough-minded, but after hearing a tearjerker like that, he granted her asylum. The truth, Caroline admitted to The New Yorker, was that she had come to the United States with her family for a wedding the previous summer and decided to stay. The immigrant community in the United States provided her with fake identity cards and social security numbers and those heinous rape stories. They had initially suggested she claim genital mutilation, but female circumcision is not practiced in her country, so she went the rape torture route. I have never been raped, she laughingly told The New Yorker. Asked about the lenient approach of our immigration system toward asylum claims, Dana Marks, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, said she always errs on the side of granting asylum because, quote, the mistake of granting a fraudulent asylum case is far less disastrous than denying a genuine one. Disastrous for whom? Automatic entry for the worst cultures in the world. The entire world outside of America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and parts of Western Europe is a humanitarian crisis. We're not even rescuing the real victims, who are either dead or can't catch an international flight to the United States. In any event, that's not our job. When, by some freak accident, an English-speaking, non-welfare-receiving, Christian, Western European family applies for asylum, the government will spend 6 years trying to hound them out of the country. That's what happened to the young German family that sought asylum on the actually true grounds that the German government was going to take their children away unless they ceased homeschooling them. As a huffy Ralph de la Cruz complained in the Dallas Morning News, if not having the right to homeschool in Germany constitutes persecution, wouldn't something like beheadings of the local population by drug cartels also qualify? That's how asylum is used to turn America into a dumping ground for the most backward people on earth. No advanced country could ever produce the sort of persecution our immigration laws reward, so the asylum welcome mat gets rolled out only for criminals, scam artists, and terrorists. They're less persecuted than the German family was, but they come from horribly backward cultures, so it's easy to cook up a good story. After 6 years of litigation, the Department of Homeland Security finally stopped trying to deport the German family, granting them indefinite deferred action status. You can see them on display in my immigration museum as the only asylum applicants in 50 years who didn't immediately go on welfare. Shut it down. The only way to stop the nonsense is to have an immigration moratorium. It would be nice to get some British and Dutch immigrants again, but it's not worth the risk of keeping our immigration bureaucracy in business. Just shut it down. No more family reunification, no more scam marriages, no more refugees, no more phony asylum cases, which is all of them, and no more high-tech workers providing slave labor to Microsoft and concubines to Indian pedophiles. No legal fixes can make a dent in our behemoth immigration apparatus. Until every last special pleader for mass immigration from the third world is out of business, the country cannot be safe. They won't want to, quote, cry because they don't feel wanted and are abused in many ways, as immigrants to America do, according to Dr. Manuel Carballo, executive director of the International Center for Migration, Health, and Development at Columbia University. They won't experience, quote, harassment, hardship, and discrimination in Alabama, as the Southern Poverty Law Center says they do. Have immigrants heard about America's gun fetish? The college rape epidemic? The lack of safe and easy access to abortion? We're doing them a favor. If America could get a timeout on endless immigration from the third world, we'd have a chance to reform ourselves and drain these deep sewers of depravity, racism, and xenophobia that liberals keep finding around every corner. They'll be happier. We'll be happier. After a half century of taking in the hardest cases in the world, America needs a little me time. Chapter 16. I wrote this chapter after noticing how stupid rich people are. Historically, when Republicans ignore white voters, they lose. When they ignore minorities and drive up the white vote, they win. Reagan took out a sitting president in 1980 by sweeping the New Deal coalition, except for blacks and Hispanics, according to a Washington Post analysis. 4 years later, Reagan's share of the black vote declined further. He won 9% of the black vote, the smallest percentage captured by any Republican presidential candidate between Lyndon Johnson's 1964 landslide and Barack Obama's candidacy in 2008. He also won the largest electoral landslide in U.S. history. Explaining the Democrats' drubbing in the 1984 presidential election, The Washington Post's Richard Harwood said Democrats had made a historic miscalculation by obsessing over the black vote. Although Southern blacks came through and voted 90% for Walter Mondale, Reagan swept the South with 75% of the white vote. Rule of thumb, Republicans, if you aren't being called racist by the New York Times, you're losing. With Democrats always gassing on about how Hispanics are going to turn Texas blue, as happened to California, no one seems to have noticed that Texas already has more Hispanics than California. Hispanics in Texas are no different from the ones in California. Both block vote for Democrats by about 60 to 75%. The difference is, white Texans vote overwhelmingly Republican, whereas white Californians split their vote. In 2012, whites were 55% of the California electorate, but they voted only 53% for Romney. That same year, whites were 56% of the Texas electorate, but they voted 80% for Romney. 80%! The New York Times famed statistician, Nate Cohn, estimates that in 2012, Obama got the smallest percentage of the white vote in Texas of any Democrat in history at 18.9%. So how have the media, Democrats, and cheap labor enthusiasts managed to convince Republicans to focus like a laser beam on winning slightly more of the Hispanic vote? We must consider the possibility that they do not have Republicans' best interests at heart. Blacks and Hispanics are not swing voters. Whites are. It would be as if Republicans tricked the Democrats into devoting all their efforts to getting a tiny sliver more of the fundamentalist Christian vote. The GOP's addiction to lobbyist money is killing the party. The off-the-charts popularity of opposing illegal immigration. In 1994, Governor Pete Wilson of California pulled off an amazing come-from-behind victory by tethering himself with titanium cords to Proposition 187, which prohibited illegal aliens from collecting public services. Wilson went from a catastrophic 15% job approval rating to a landslide victory. Suddenly, he was being touted as presidential material. This wasn't the California of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, a storybook era when Republicans could easily win that state. Just 2 years earlier, Republicans had been walloped in three statewide elections, two Senate elections, and a presidential election. But Wilson won his 1994 re-election with 55% of the vote, which is the largest percentage of any Republican running statewide in California in the last 30 years, other than Hollywood movie star and virtual Democrat Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who won his 2006 re-election by precisely 1 point more than Wilson got in 1994. Before the election, the New York Times had the exact same advice for Wilson that it does for the Republican National Committee today. The Times urgently warned Wilson that he was headed for a humiliating defeat by supporting Proposition 187, which was, in the words of the Times, a nativist abomination, xenophobic, and a platform of bigotry, racism, and scapegoating. Republicans faced an epic loss unless they repudiated Proposition 187 and leapt on the hispandering bandwagon. And pronto, there wasn't a moment to spare. Luckily, Wilson wasn't RNC chairman Reince Priebus, so he didn't take the Times' advice. As it turned out, Proposition 187 got even more votes than Wilson, winning 59% to 41%. It was supported by two-thirds of white voters, 56% of black voters, 57% of Asian voters, and even a third of Hispanic voters. It won in every county of California except San Francisco, a city where intoxicated gay men dressed as nuns performing sex acts on city streets is not considered unusual. In heavily Latino Los Angeles County, Proposition 187 passed by a 12-point margin. The nativist abomination lifted Republicans across the state and ended the Democrats' quarter-century control of the California State Assembly. Even Michael Huffington nearly beat popular incumbent Senator Dianne Feinstein in an election that wasn't called until days later. Contrary to the media's predictions, Proposition 187 did not motivate more Latinos to come out and vote, according to Susan Pincus, director of the Los Angeles Times exit poll. Refugio Trujillo, for example, a lifelong Democrat with a sign for Wilson's opponent in his lawn, was among the one-third of Hispanics who supported the initiative, telling the San Jose Mercury News, quote, "We have too many aliens out here." Not only did one-third of Hispanics support Proposition 187, but black voters came out in droves for Wilson. In House races nationwide that year, Republicans won only 8% of the black vote. Wilson won 21% of black voters. Interestingly, that's nearly the identical percentage Romney won from young black males in 2012 by refusing to budge in his opposition to illegal immigration. To give you a sense of what a monumental Republican triumph Proposition 187 was, after the election, the media lashed out at California voters, calling them bitter and angry. Unfortunately for her, Wilson's Democratic opponent, Kathleen Brown, didn't realize that the Times hectoring on Proposition 187 was a gag. It was only supposed to fake out Republicans. Convinced that opposition to Prop 187 was surging, days before the election, Brown asked voters to, quote, "send a message that says we understand that indiversity is our strength." Landslide for Wilson. Only 10% of Brown's voters cited her opposition to the proposition as a reason to support her. But nearly a third of Wilson's voters cited his support of it as their number one reason for supporting him. Is Kathleen Brown advising the RNC on its Hispanic outreach? Nice try, gringos. The response from Mexico was swift. Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari wailed, "Will they return to Mexico, wash windshields in California, sell newspapers on the street, or beg?" Evidently, he wasn't worried about losing Mexico's top talent to America through illegal immigration. His government began setting up homeless shelters on the Mexican side of the border. Masked men stormed McDonald's franchises, smashed plate glass windows, turned over cash registers, threw hamburgers on the floor, and spray-painted anti-American slogans on the walls. Our new country is going to be great. The response from American liberals was swifter. The ACLU and other anti-American groups brought suit and got the initiative overturned by the courts, courtesy of Carter-appointed District Court Judge Mariana Filzer. Apparently, shots were fired by brave patriots in 1775 on the North Bridge in Concord so that their descendants might one day be forced to support any Mexican who manages to sneak across the border. Today, Los Angeles is the second biggest Mexican city in the world. Its taxpayers are required to spend billions of dollars for the education, healthcare, food, housing, and jail cells for illegal immigrants. According to the California Department of Education, 2/3 of the public school students in the Los Angeles Unified School District are Hispanic. Sun-drenched California suddenly has all the problems of a third-world country because the third world has moved there. Don't worry, Republicans. They'll respect you in the morning. After getting a court to nullify the popularly enacted Prop 187, the left's most urgent priority was to make sure Republicans never tried anything like that again. At the time, of course, no one could deny the truth. On the eve of the election, ABC reported that Proposition 187 had brought Wilson, quote, from behind into a narrow lead in a year when incumbents everywhere are threatened with extinction. The Economist magazine said that even in heavily Democratic Oregon, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Denny Smith, made late gains in his campaign by saying he thought Proposition 187 a fine thing. But as soon as memories faded, the media began relentlessly rewriting the story of Proposition 187 as a catastrophe for the GOP. If I didn't know better, I'd say the media don't want the GOP to win landslide victories. Republicans fall for it every time. Nearly 20 years later, after the 2012 presidential election, the RNC paid $10 million for a report that concluded, to broaden its appeal, the party must embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform. If we do not, our party's appeal will continue to shrink. I could have told them how to lose for, say, $8 million. It all sounds vaguely familiar. Wait, I remember. That's the exact advice given to Wilson in 1994 by the New York Times, the Republicans' dearest, most trusted friend in the whole wide world. In fact, however, if Romney had won 71% of the Hispanic vote in 2012 instead of 27%, he still would have lost. On the other hand, had he won just 4% more of the white vote, he would have won. So what did Reince Priebus, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, John Boehner, and all rich Republicans decide their sole mission should be after the 2012 election? Win a few more points of the Hispanic vote. The Washington Post's Chris Ciliza was totally impressed. He cited the report's conclusion, saying, that's 100% right. And when Chris Ciliza tells Republicans they're on the right track, the party had better sit up and listen. Pete Wilson's victory on the back of Proposition 187 ought to be studied by today's GOP like General Eisenhower's Operation Overlord. Not only was it a stunning success in defiance of the Times' predictions, but contemporary America has nearly the exact same demographic makeup as California did in 1994, a.k.a. the California Republicans swept with an anti-illegal alien initiative. In 1994, California was 75% white, 12% Hispanic, 6% Asian, and 7% African American. Today, the American electorate is 72% white, 10% Hispanic, 3% Asian, and 13% African American. Will any rich Republican donor ever notice? Bush empties the Republican Party. President Bush's record-breaking 40% of the Hispanic vote in his 2004 re-election is cited as a model for Republican office seekers. Let's review. Reagan ticked off the only minority group that mattered in 1984 and won a historic landslide. Bush sucked up to Hispanics and barely won his re-election as a wartime president running against a complete nincompoop. And look at what Bush had to do to get 40% of the Hispanic vote. He carried his half-Mexican nephew, George P. Bush, around on the campaign trail as if he were an extra appendage, giving him a primetime slot at the Republican National Convention for a speech delivered partially in Spanish. He was the first president to give weekly radio addresses in Spanish and also added a Spanish language page to the White House website. He campaigned in America with Mexico's president. He held a huge Cinco de Mayo fiesta at the White House. He gave speeches to the racist National Council of La Raza, promising $100 million in federal funds to speed immigration applications. Bush's hispandering didn't even win him a majority of Hispanics. But it did tick off his base, leading to a blowout loss for his party 2 years later. The conservative Christian base that had carried Bush to victory in 2004 turned against him with a vengeance over amnesty, wiping out Bush's party in the House, Senate, and state governorships. In the 2006 election, only 77% of conservatives voted Republican, compared with 91% of liberals who voted Democrat. 36% of voters said they cast their vote specifically to oppose Bush, and he wasn't on the ballot. That's even more than the 27% who voted to oppose Bill Clinton in the 1994 Republican sweep of Congress. It's hard to argue that Bush's betrayal of conservatives on immigration was not the central factor in Republicans' catastrophic 2006 losses. Other than Bush's obsessive fixation on passing amnesty, there wasn't much new that year. Liberals like to tell the story of how their courageous opposition to the Iraq War finally won the public's hearts and minds, ushering in a Democratic Congress in 2006. But that's not what the public opinion surveys show. Dozens of Gallup polls on the Iraq War from the moment we invaded in March 2003 to June 2014 show public support for the war declining from 75% to 50% 2 years into the war, then mostly remaining in the 40s thereafter. It was Bush's neurotic demand that the Senate take up comprehensive immigration reform in March 2006 that enraged Americans. A Washington Post ABC News poll in April 2006 showed more Americans approved of Bush's handling of the Iraq War than approved of his handling of immigration. In nearly every poll on Bush's handling of immigration that year, about 60% of the public disapproved, with only 25% approving, the latter figure giving us a rough estimate of how many Americans acquire their opinions exclusively from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Newsweek, May 11, 2006 poll. 61% disapproved of the way Bush is handling immigration policy, only 25% approved. New York Times CBS News poll, May 4 through 8, 2006. 58% disapproved of the way George Bush is handling the issue of immigration, 26% approved. Pew Center poll, April 7 through 16, 2006. 62% disapproved of the way George Bush is handling the nation's immigration policy, 25% approved. Time Magazine poll, March 29, 2006. 56% disapproved of the job President Bush is doing in handling the immigration problem, 25% approved. Gallup has been asking Americans to name the most important problem facing this country for years. Going back decades, immigration had ranked as the most important problem for only about 4-5% of respondents. Then suddenly, in April 2006, just after Bush had launched his plan for comprehensive immigration reform, immigration shot to the number one problem for 30% of Republicans, 16% of independents, and 11% of Democrats. Lest there be any misunderstanding, poll respondents didn't think immigration was a problem the way Bush thought it was a problem. 61% of Americans wanted to criminalize illegal aliens. 53% of Pew respondents said illegal immigrants should be, quote, required to go home. 20% of respondents in a Washington Post ABC News poll agreed with, declare all illegal immigrants to be felons. Compiling results from a series of polls in February and March 2006, Pew Research found that about 90% of Americans called illegal immigration a serious problem, while a clear majority called it a very or extremely serious problem. 79% of those with less tolerant views on immigration, as ABC News put it, said immigration would be a top issue in their vote. As long as Bush had brought it up, Americans said they wanted to stop legal immigration, too. In the Quinnipiac poll, 72% of respondents wanted immigration to decrease or stay at the same levels. In the Pew Hispanic Center poll, 77% of Americans wanted immigration to decrease or stay the same. Even in the New York Times CBS poll, 73% opposed an increase in legal immigration. More Americans support Obamacare than support an increase in legal immigration. Gallup found that nearly 60% of Americans considered the country's future population growth a major problem, and those with less formal education were most likely to correctly attribute population growth to immigration, while Americans with postgraduate education are least likely to do so. Apart from the maid, immigration is barely noticeable in the better neighborhoods. Midterm elections, the New York Times has said, tend to be won by whichever side can motivate more true believers to vote. There's no question but that Bush's push for amnesty in 2006 infuriated his base. In June 2006, influential conservative leaders, including Brent Bozell, Phyllis Schlafly, and Howard Phillips, issued a statement lambasting the amnesty plan being pushed by Bush, as well as a compromise measure proposed by Republican Congressman Mike Pence. The leaders pledged to oppose any member of Congress who voted for either bill. You've got one move, GOP. It's a sucker's game to think that Republicans can ever get to the Democrats' left on immigration. A terrible year for Democrats is winning only 60% of the Hispanic vote. The vast majority of the Democrats' ethnic base is voting for them no matter what. There could have been a 1929 stock market crash in 2012, and Obama still would have won more than 90% of the black vote and upward of 70% of the Hispanic and Asian vote. When they're being honest, Democrats admit that Republicans are delusional if they think they're making any inroads with Latinos, as Texas Democratic Party spokesman Rebecca Acuña said in 2012. Acuña noted that out of 728 elected Hispanic officials in Texas, 668 of them were Democrats. Only 60 were Republicans. The GOP's only move is to run the table on white voters, as Reagan did. By unapologetically opposing the transformation of America into a third world country, the GOP would sweep the white vote, once white people recovered from the shock of any candidate asking for their vote. Why should Republicans be ashamed of getting white votes? How about the party working on getting more of them? By fighting for black jobs, Republicans will also win a lot more black voters, as Romney did in 2012, winning a jaw-dropping 20% of the young black male vote. Unfortunately, the public's opinion is of little interest to Republican consultants who have hefty college tuition bills to pay. Their solitary interest is in pleasing big donors by constantly apologizing to Hispanics for not moving fast enough on amnesty. They would rather engineer a 49-state defeat than abandon the cheap labor advocates on immigration. What might these genius GOP operatives think about a presidential candidate running ads bashing immigrant welfare scams? Something like, she is collecting Social Security on her cards. She's got Medicaid, getting food stamps, and she is collecting welfare under each of her names. Her tax-free cash income is over $150,000. What if a Republican presidential candidate accused self-appointed Hispanic leaders of running organizations based on keeping alive the feeling that they're victims of prejudice? I'm guessing that wouldn't impress the big thinkers in the GOP who are squeamish about self-deportation. But Reagan said all that and was called a racist. And he won the largest electoral landslide in history. Chapter 17. Most of our champions are sellouts. Half of the rest are incompetent. The practiced liars in the Republican Party know damn well Americans do not want more immigration, but the leadership won't give it up. To please well-heeled donors, elected Republicans compulsively push for amnesty, in-state tuition, driver's licenses, and welfare payments for illegals. And the media cover for them, Don't worry, we won't write about what you're doing with immigration. And if we do, it will only be to talk about your moral courage, Marco. Only when they need actual voters do Republicans suddenly start saying, complete the dang fence. 2008 McCain campaign. It's always interesting to see what politicians lie about. At least they know what's actually popular with voters. Back when he was running for office, Senator Marco Rubio criticized comprehensive immigration reform, saying, quote, an earned path to citizenship is basically code for amnesty. He pledged, I will never support, never have, and never will support any effort to grant blanket legalization amnesty to folks who have entered this country illegally. Then Rubio got to Washington and spent the next 3 years pushing for amnesty. Representative Renee Elmers of North Carolina came out for a path to legalization and, as a result, was headed for defeat, until Mark Zuckerberg came to her rescue with election ads that claimed her position was no amnesty, period. Within a month of returning to Congress, Elmers voted in favor of Obama's executive amnesty. I guess it depends on what the meaning of the word period is. So we know they know where Americans stand on immigration. Please stop. In February 2015, more Americans said they had a favorable opinion of North Korea, 11%, than wanted to increase immigration, 7%. The baffling question is why Americans are so utterly incapable of influencing public policy on immigration. True, all the money and power are on the other side of the issue. Zuckerberg, Rupert Murdoch, Michael Bloomberg, Sheldon Adelson, Rudy Giuliani, all of them support amnesty and mass immigration. But the rich and powerful also support gun control and abortion. Again, Zuckerberg, Murdoch, Bloomberg, Adelson, and Giuliani. Money and power don't seem to help them on those issues. It's impossible to imagine a Republican candidate for president who is not pro-life and pro-gun. But it's becoming increasingly impossible to imagine a Republican candidate for president who doesn't support amnesty. Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Rick Perry, Mike Huckabee, George, Jeb, Zeppo, and Shemp Bush. Why is that? At least as many Americans would like to see a total immigration moratorium as support gun rights and oppose abortion. So why does National Right to Life have decisive influence over the Republican Party while Numbers USA has none? Why do gun owners of America always win, while immigration opponents always lose? More Americans oppose amnesty than oppose restrictions on guns. But even after the mass shooting at a grade school in Newtown, Connecticut, Congress was able to enact no new gun laws. By contrast, even after immigrants bombed the Boston Marathon, Congress went ahead and funded Obama's unconstitutional amnesty. The reason the National Rifle Association wins is because it knows how politics works. Gun activists do not try to discern what a politician believes in his heart or try to take the measure of the man. They look at voting records, specifically a politician's record on guns. Rather famously, the NRA will not oppose any politician who votes right on guns, no matter how awful he is on every other issue, Harry Reid, and they will not support a politician who opposes gun rights, no matter how wonderful he is on other issues, Rudy Giuliani. The NRA doesn't demand some impossible political purity. If a politician votes to protect gun rights, the NRA won't insist that he also celebrate Gun Appreciation Day. Vote for gun rights and you will be rewarded on Election Day. Oppose gun rights and you will be punished. Left to their consultants, most elected officials would be terrified to oppose gun control. Instead, they're terrified to oppose the NRA. By contrast, most immigration opponents seem to have no concept of how to influence politicians. They announce that Senator Jeff Sessions or Representative Steve King are the only acceptable presidential candidates and think their job is done. Consequently, Americans who would like to vote on immigration have no idea which governors granted illegals in-state tuition and which governors vetoed those bills. Conservative leaders won't tell them. Their long-term plan is to keep demanding that Jeff Sessions run for president and stay home and pout if Tom Tancredo isn't anywhere on the ballot. There are plenty of enticements for selling out on immigration, but none for doing the right thing. If the NRA behaved this way, the country would be living under the policies of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. How about we look at politicians' actual records on this one issue? America's suicidal immigration policies are the single biggest threat facing the nation. What happens with immigration will determine whether America continues to exist or becomes a third-world republic that will never elect another Republican. In other words, California. It's more important than gun rights, right to life, taxes, Iran's nuclear program, or whatever other issue you care to cite, because immigration will decide all issues, once and for all, in favor of the Democrats. Voter Guide. Now ask yourself if you had any idea where the following presidential candidates stood on immigration, and tell me if immigration activists are doing their job. Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is what's known as a wolf in wolf's clothing on immigration. As governor of Florida, he aggressively pushed a bill that would allow illegal aliens to obtain driver's licenses, less than 3 years after 13 of the 19 terrorists in the September 11th attack had used Florida driver's licenses to board the planes. And Jeb is supposed to be the smart one. In 2012, Jeb openly refused to endorse Romney before the Florida primary because of Romney's opposition to amnesty. He made it well known to the press that he was offended by Romney's statement that illegal aliens would self-deport when the jobs dried up. The day before the primary, Laura Bush showed up in Sarasota, Florida, and announced that both she and George wished Jeb were in the race. Demonstrating the Bush family's uncanny feel for the concerns of ordinary Americans, the next day, Romney swept the Florida primary, winning 46% of the vote in an 8-person field. He did better among Florida's Hispanic voters than with Republican voters at large. Throughout the rest of the year, Jeb kept running to the press, saying Romney should tone down his harsh rhetoric on issues like illegal immigration, as the New York Times admiringly put it. This was fantastically helpful in a close presidential election. About once a month since then, one or another Bush has issued a statement lecturing Republicans about Romney's harsh tone on immigration. This always makes the New York Times swoon. Needless to say, the Times could barely contain its esteem for Jeb when in April 2014, he called illegal immigration an act of love. Rick Perry. Texas Governor Rick Perry pushed for Texas's in-state tuition for illegals, then lectured Republicans about it, saying, "If you say that we should not educate children who've come into our state for no other reason than they've been brought there by no fault of their own, I don't think you have a heart." Romney's response, "I think if you're opposed to illegal immigration, it doesn't mean that you don't have a heart. It means that you have a heart and a brain." Perry opposes E-Verify. He also opposes a fence, either on the grounds that he has a witty quip about ladders or because, quote, "The idea that you're going to build a wall from Brownsville to El Paso is just, it's ridiculous on its face. Wait until Perry hears about the Great Wall of China." He opposed the Arizona law allowing state officials to check the immigration status of those they've detained, as did Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Chris Christie. Governor Chris Christie was famously duped by Senator Chuck Schumer into supporting comprehensive immigration reform. Schumer considered Christie such a patsy that he immediately leaked the news that he had buffaloed Christie on amnesty in a single 30-minute phone call. Christie's Senate appointee then voted for the bill. A few months later, Christie doubled down on amnesty by giving in-state tuition to illegal aliens. Rand Paul. Senator Rand Paul calls illegal aliens undocumented citizens and has fully banished the word amnesty from his vocabulary, using the word normalize instead. He even refers to Reagan's amnesty, which everyone calls amnesty, as a time when, quote, "we normalized people back in 1986. Paul frequently cites the imaginary tax boon we'll get by dumping 30 million poor people on the country. He coos to illegal immigrants, or undocumented citizens, "we will find a place for you," and We're saying you don't have to go home. He demands that we acknowledge that we aren't going to deport 12 million illegal immigrants. Instead of a fence, the libertarian wants the government to tell us when the border is secure. Under pressure from his base, Paul voted against the Schumer-Rubio amnesty, but promptly backtracked. In under a year, Paul was warning conservatives that, quote, the Hispanic community is not going to hear us until we get beyond this immigration issue. He began cutting ads for the amnesty-supporting Chamber of Commerce. He got fantastic press from the New York Times, which was expected, but he also continued to be cited as a true blue conservative warrior by alleged conservatives. Even after Paul's about-face on amnesty, Chris Chocolat, then president of the Club for Growth, hailed him as one of the important Tea Party conservatives who influenced the rest of them. Rick Santorum. In his 12 years in the Senate, Rick Santorum showed no interest in immigration, a point made by his 2006 Democratic opponent, Bob Casey, when Santorum tried to use illegal immigration as an election issue. Republicans are fiercely opposed to immigration whenever they need our votes. Santorum did vote against the 2006 Kennedy-McCain amnesty, but he also voted against sanctions on employers who hire illegals, another point made by Casey, who ended up winning the election. In his 2012 presidential campaign, Santorum continued to oppose punishing employers who use illegal alien labor. Ted Cruz. In September 2012, Senator Ted Cruz told the New York Times, I have said many times that I want to see common sense immigration reform pass. He expressly rejected the idea of self-deportation, saying that he had never tried to undo the goal of allowing them to stay. His main interest in immigration, he told the Times, was the real need for labor by farmers and ranchers. He said he also wanted to change the law so that even more Mexicans and Chinese could immigrate here legally. Cruz voted against the Rubio amnesty bill, but proposed amendments that would double legal immigration from 675,000 a year to 1.3 million a year, and to quintuple the number of high-tech H-1B visas from 65,000 to 325,000 per year. Even Rubio's bill only increased high-tech visas, a.k.a. tickets into the country, for lackey-ready, bally-ready's concubines, to 180,000 a year. Cruz also offered an amendment that would theoretically prevent amnestied illegal aliens from ever obtaining citizenship. Most amnesty opponents breathed a sigh of relief when it failed. It would have been overturned by a court in 5 minutes, but would have made the amnesty bill deceptively attractive. After the Schumer-Rubio bill passed, Cruz blasted it as amnesty, a word that few other elected Republicans are willing to use under any circumstances. So perhaps, like Governor Scott Walker, Cruz has flip-flopped to America's side on immigration. Given the likely field of GOP presidential candidates, purer-than-thou conservatives better get ready to do some flip-flopping of their own on flip-flopping candidates. Mitt Romney. As governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney repeatedly vetoed bills giving illegal aliens in-state tuition, and the legislature was never able to override him. He made clear that he would also veto any bill allowing driver's licenses for illegal aliens, so those never made it to his desk. He vetoed a bill to give health coverage to illegal aliens, but the legislature overruled him. About the time Jeb Bush was pressuring the Florida legislature to give illegals driver's licenses, Romney sought and received a special agreement with federal immigration officials allowing Massachusetts state troopers to arrest illegal aliens. Romney was Jan Brewer before Jan Brewer was Jan Brewer. For this, Romney was unremittingly attacked by third-world immigration boosters such as Senator Teddy Kennedy and activist Ali Nourani. The Democratic Attorney General of Massachusetts, Thomas Riley, called a press conference to denounce Governor Romney as mean-spirited for vetoing the bill to give illegals in-state tuition. In response, Romney invited the press to his office and showed them that the proposed reduction in tuition would cost the state millions of dollars a year. Romney is the only serious presidential candidate ever to support E-Verify and Defense on the Border, unequivocally. The media, GOP consultants, the big donors, and the Bush family all attacked him for his suggestion that illegal aliens would self-deport. Media darling John McCain blustered to The New Yorker that everybody agrees that Romney's biggest mistake was to say, quote, self-deport. Chuckling at the madness of it, McCain said, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry when I heard that, because you can't have 11 million self-deport. How does McCain think they got here? Despite ferocious blowback and zero support from people allegedly opposed to amnesty, Romney never backed away from his immigration positions, not even after Rupert Murdoch insisted that he change his position in a private meeting a few months before the election. The point of this exercise is to ask, why didn't you know that, reader? Why, to this day, do so many conservatives tout Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz as bold colors, no pastels Republicans, especially compared to that miserable establishment rhino, Mitt Romney? Would the NRA hide truthful information about candidates' positions on guns from their members? Immigration groups do. Numbers USA gave Romney a C-plus on immigration. C-plus! Anti-immigration websites carped about Romney throughout the campaign. What does he have to do, build the fence himself? Fake conservatives and Tea Partiers followed the crowd and slammed Romney as an establishment Republican. Alleged conservative spokesmen put Romney in the same camp as Chris Christie and Jeb Bush. It would be as if gun rights supporters couldn't tell the difference between Senator Joni Ernst and Representative Carolyn McCarthy, or pro-lifers described Rick Santorum and Susan Collins in the same breath. On the eve of the Republican sweep in the 2014 midterm elections, Romney predicted on Fox News Sunday that a Republican Congress would, quote, deal with those who come here illegally. Heaven help him if he had said self-deport again. Conservatives went ballistic, accusing him of supporting amnesty, betraying them, losing his marbles. Within hours, Breitbart.com was headlining Sarah Palin's denunciation of Romney. Gov Romney is in Never Never Land on this one. Maybe amnesty is what Romney meant when he said, deal with the illegal immigrants already here, although he had never supported it before, despite enormous pressure to do so. But do these hairy-chested amnesty opponents know that every other possible GOP presidential candidate has said explicitly what they're accusing Romney of saying implicitly? There's some weird psychological block when conservatives are fiery with indignation at Romney for a vague statement about immigration, because it could be interpreted to mean what every other Republican says in no uncertain terms. The NRA never loses, and the anti-immigration groups never win, because immigration opponents don't lift a finger to help politicians who are on their side. Voters are dying to send a message on immigration, but all they get is lies from alleged conservatives about how to do that. Romney must wonder why he bothered holding a position so unpopular with his donors on immigration. Perhaps he genuinely believes that turning America into Mexico is a bad idea. Chamber of Commerce. You can't have everything. Democrats have no choice but to keep pushing to admit ever more poor immigrants. They can't win without the votes of the third world. The intentional transformation of America into some other country ought to be killing them at the polls, but it's not, because Democrats have hoodwinked Republicans into pushing for the exact same thing. How did Republicans end up on the wrong side of the question? Should the Democrats be able to establish their political hegemony for all time? Any party incapable of winning the vote of white men ought to hang its head in shame. Instead, Democrats denounce and abuse white people, and Republicans act embarrassed about having whites vote for them. Why are white votes bad? To be sure, black Americans don't like mass immigration either, but Democrats don't care what blacks think. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell needs to get business lobbyists in a car and drive them around with a gun to their heads for an hour, explaining, we can give you regulatory reform, OSHA reform, tax relief, tort reform, but if we give you immigration, we won't be in a position to give you anything else ever again, and you'll have to take your chances with Nancy Pelosi. The Chamber of Commerce has got to learn You can't have it all. Then Republicans should ask Democrats, why is it so vitally important to keep bringing in new workers to compete with low-skilled Americans and drive down their wages? The endless flow of needy immigrants is soaking up every last dollar of government aid, every low-wage job, every hour of assistance, every quantum of charitable giving. After all the country has been through only since 9/11, two wars, repeated terrorist attacks, the housing crash, widespread unemployment and underemployment, America needs to worry about Americans. How much is the price of guilt for having a successful society before we're entitled to say to the poor of the world, enough, we gave it the office? Acknowledgements. Legions of people who have read this book shall remain nameless, on account of the maniacal blacklisting in store for anyone with second thoughts about turning America into Mexico. But some in my crowd are either crazy enough or love their country enough to allow me to thank them publicly without even using aliases. Ned Rice is, as ever, a joke-writing machine. I'd rush to finish chapters just to see what jokes he'd come up with, many for my own amusement, but a lot also made it into the book. Same with Jim Hughes, who does not write professionally, but rather saves his best work for when he signs onto the computer late at night after a few cocktails. Trish Baker and Robert Kaplan have been on this subject for years, sending me news items, in addition to religiously reading and editing every chapter. Melanie Graham, one of my circle of deciders, always emailed back immediately and gave me a line that still makes me laugh. Meryl Kinsler, one of my regular talking partners for about 15 years, let a few of my books slip by without comment. Not this one. Noticeably, Ned, Jim, Trish, Robert, Melanie, and Meryl are all Californians, so they have a close-up view of what our new country is going to be like. In fact, nearly all my friends who are willing to be named are Californians. It's remarkable how quickly people in a state that has been overwhelmed with illegal aliens are able to grasp the fine points of my thesis. If it's not a hit in 2015, this book will be huge as soon as the other 49 states become California, without the great weather and gorgeous beaches. I'm sorry to be the one to inform you of this, but that will make all of you the Kardashians. Others who have helped with this book, mostly by reading chapters and voting on titles, but in other ways as well, are Bill Armistead, John Caldera, Rodney Conover, Mallory and Thomas Danaher, David Friedman, James Fulford, Ron Gordon, Kevin Harrington, David Limbaugh, Jay Mann, Jim Moody, Dan Travers, John Tuckle, Marshall Sella, Peter Thiel, Kelly Victory, and Eunice Zubchevich. Also, thanks to Regnery for publishing this book and to my editors, Elizabeth Cantor and Margie Ross, for helping me cut 150 pages when it was approaching the length of The Story of Civilization by Will and Ariel Durant. Challenge any sentence in this book, and I've got 50 more examples waiting in the outtakes. And thanks to Stephen N. Hopkins for helping record this book, which would have gone a lot faster if recent immigrants had names like John Smith instead of Akron Tai Charatana Prasert. Finally, everyone mentioned here agrees with every single word in this book. Don't let them tell you otherwise. Adios, America, the outtakes. In an attempt to properly pronounce the many, many foreign names in this book, errors were made. In order to show you the extra mile I go for my fans, and also help you understand why the recording of the foreign names took the length of Wagner's Ring Cycle, I've decided to include some of the outtakes. Herewith, the director's cut. Uh-oh. Arkrin Tai Char... I wrote it down someplace. Let me see if I wrote it. Here, I have it on the next page. I did it phonetically on the next page. Hang on. I have... Let me try that. Akron Tai... Wait. Taicharatana Prasert. Taicharatana Prasert. Akron Taichana Charatana Prasert. Akron Taicharatana Prasert. Akron Taicharatana Prasert. No. Prasert. Taicharatana Prasert. Ticharatana Prasser. Okay, we'll take that again. In 2002, Minneapolis police shot a Somali man, Abu Qasim Jalani. Do I care if that's how you pronounce his name? In a widely ridiculed 1898 case, United States versus Wong Kim Ark. Shuhail Mahbub Ali. Shahul Mahbub Ali. Is that right? I'm changing pile of dirt to turd in this paragraph. They have no sense of humor. Turd is always funny. Yes. Okay. Well, fasten your seatbelt. Jesse Enrique Monares. Cesar Augusto Nistal. Jose Padilla. I'm going to skip his middle initial. Who cares? Demacio. Oxtitlan. Cristobal. Are you sure that paragraph is okay? Fanul Andes Tess Fatshun. How do they say that? Chris or Crease? Okay. But wait, it's Cristobal. Okay. In 2012, Satish Naranayappa. Very sorry. Collado. Beatrice Munyenyezi. Carlin Kachatarian and Hartoon. I can't do them together. Oh, that's right. Not the chicken. Carlin Kachatrian and Hartunium. I can't do them. Okay. Estrella Perez, Solchis Perez, and Abigail Aguila. That's a good name. Donna Takushi, Jenny Nishida, and Nicole Chung, right? Donna Takushi, Jenny Nishida, and Nicole Chung. Convicted in credit union embezzlement. Wait a second. This is a repetition. You see, I'm sorry, who is supposed to catch this? The publisher. Zareen Ahmedze? No, I can only do one at a time. Okay, now you can tell me. Adis Madunjanin, or do I need to do the first one again? Okay. Adis Mendunjanin? Mahmoud Syed Omar. Oh, it is? Mahmoud Syed Omar. Kabdallahi Ahmed Farax. Do you pronounce the X at the end there? I can't get that. Is it Deshi? Deshi? Azizur? Where's the stress on Azizur? I like this one. Looks like dickweed. I could throw it in and no one would notice. Dilshad. I never know how to say this. How do you say it? Chowdhury. Are you sure I don't have to do any of those again? That's because you think it'll be funny with me mispronouncing them. Okay, I'm going to try one more time. If Americans realize that there are probably three times as many illegal aliens here as we're constantly being told... Oh! I'm so sorry. Water fell. Sorry. Oh, shoot. Nincompoop? You didn't have my father. The end. El final. Until we have edits. Oh, I'm so happy. This has been Adios America, the left's plan to turn our country into a third world hellhole. Written by Ann Coulter. Narrated by Ann Coulter. Copyright 2015, Ann Coulter. Production copyright 2015 by Van Varick.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.